tempted. The historic part of downtown looked like it'd be fun to explore, and it was a perfect summer evening, warm and breezy. Then I thought about the alchemists finding me and locking me away again, forcing me to repeat their rhetoric and undergo their tortures. My chest grew tight, and I shook my head. I'll just wait in our room until we go back to the museum.
They don't know you're here, he said softly, watching me with a careful eye. And I wouldn't let any of them get near you anyway.
I shook my head. Better play it safe. When it was fully dark outside, we drove back to the robot museum and parked a few blocks away, making the rest of the journey on foot. Metal grates had been closed and locked in front of all the windows and doors, and a sign warned that there was an electronic alarm on the door.
No sign that the windows are rigged with an alarm,
said Eddie after inspecting it closely.
In fact, you can see that one of them's still open behind its metal grate, probably to air the place out.
Even though it was well into night, the summer heat and humidity were still going strong.
No cameras inside, and none that I see here either, added Ms. Terwilliger.
I guess they sunk all their budget into the Raptor bot, I said. Not that it seems to be bringing in the customers. Eddie's brief moment of levity earlier was long gone, and he made no response to my barb. Instead, he examined the metal grate in front of the open window, his expression steely.
If I pull hard enough, I might be able to break this lock.
No need to use up your strength, said Ms. Terwilliger. I'm sure I have a spell to open it.
And no need to use up your magic, I said, stepping forward. From the depths of my large purse, I pulled out a small vial. My time cooped up in our suite at court hadn't been entirely wasted. Thanks to our questionably moral friend Abe, I'd been able to get my hand on a number of the components that went into some of the alchemists' more common chemical compounds. I'd spent my long confinement building up a stockpile of useful things, including this one, which dissolved metal pretty handily. The metal grating was like a little gate that slid out from one side of the window and latched to a lock on the opposite side. It actually might have been tough for Eddie to break it, but a few drops of the solution on the latch melted it away, releasing the gate easily. We slid it open, exposing the window. Its glass was up, with only a screen between the contents of the museum and us. Eddie took out a pocket knife, quickly and efficiently cutting open the screen. I winced in spite of myself.
I feel kind of bad, I admitted. This place isn't doing so well, and now we're damaging their property.
That's what insurance is for, said Ms. Terwilliger. Besides, if it helps us find Jill, I'm sure your queen can make an anonymous donation to this place.
Eddie helped the two of us climb up and get through the window, and then he followed deftly on his own. Inside, the gallery was empty and quiet, exactly how it was during regular business hours. The dim glow from the exit signs, as well as illumination from the street lamps outside, provided enough light for us to see by, once we gave our eyes some time to adjust. We went immediately to the Raptorbot exhibit, and this time I let Ms. Terwilliger cast an unlocking spell on the glass door. After she finished, I wondered for a moment if there might be some kind of spell on it that was keyed to me again. Then we heard an audible click, and the door swung open. Inside the case, the Raptorbot rested on top of a large stand that also had a door and an interior compartment.
No lock, I said, reaching to pull open the smaller door.
Sydney, wait, began Ms. Terwilliger, but she was too late. I'd already opened it. I froze, expecting the entire thing to explode, but after several tense seconds, nothing happened. I exhaled in relief.
Sorry, I wasn't thinking.
She nodded, still ill at ease.
I can still sense that there's some sort of magic here.
Maybe it's the object inside this, I said,
I couldn't make out the interior compartment's belongings and tentatively reached my hand into the dark space, half expecting a scorpion to sting me. Instead, my fingertips touched a large manila envelope, which I slowly pulled out. My name was written across it.
Same handwriting,
Eddie observed. I nodded in agreement. Yeah, too bad we don't have an easy way to trace. Do you hear that? I could tell from Eddie's face that his quicker hearing had already picked it up. Ms. Terwilliger took a little longer to notice. Like, buzzing. She glanced up into the raptor bot's metal face. From that! The buzzing grew louder and louder, and Eddie hurried forward to put himself between the display case and us.
Get back!
He shouted, just as the raptor bot's mouth opened and several dozen glowing objects came flying out. They came at us with unbelievable force, and I fell backward, landing awkwardly on my side. I held up my hands to block the glowing swarm, but some of them still grazed my face as they passed by. I cried out at the contact, which stung like a million paper cuts. What are they? I managed to exclaim.
Photianas!
Mr. Welliger called back. She too had hit the floor and was covering her face as the swarm came by for another pass.
Bodhi what?
Asked Eddie.
They're from the same realm Hopper comes from, but they're much less friendly.
She cautiously removed her hands from her face so she could get a line of sight on the creatures.
Think of them as mutant fireflies.
Eddie, ever ready to improvise, grabbed the welcome sign from the robot standing at the doorway. Wielding it like a baseball bat, he swung it toward the Photianas as they came toward him. As though they shared one mind, the swarm parted so that his bat hit mostly open air. Only a couple of the Photianas were too slow. They disintegrated into sparks as they were struck. That was encouraging at least, but we had a lot more of them to get through. Things grew more complicated when the swarm split into three and came after each of us. I had just gotten to my feet, but as I saw the group targeting me, in an arrow formation even, I tore across the room and managed to duck under the conveyor belt's table just in time.
What's the best way to get rid of them?
I yelled to Mr. Williger.
Fire?
Across the room, I could see Eddie continuing to nick away at them with his sign, but their speed and agility kept him from making significant progress.
I don't want to burn this place down, she called back,
trying to dodge as the swarm chasing her passed nearby. They swiped her arm, leaving tears in her sleeve and small bloody cuts visible on the skin beneath. As soon as she had some distance between her and them, she held up her hands and chanted a Latin incantation I'd never heard before. 100 tiny sparkling crystals appeared in the air before her, and with another command, she sent them flying into the Photianas. Where the crystals struck, the mutant fireflies vanished into sparks. The swarm chasing me flew low, trying to run me out from under my table. I waved them off, getting my hand stung in the process, as I parsed Mr. Williger's spell. It had been very similar in word and feel to my old friend the fireball spell, with just a few notable differences. It was an ice spell, I realized. Thrown with enough force, bits of ice could have the impact of little razors. I scurried out from under my table and tried to put some space between my swarm and me. Behind me, I heard Ms. Terwilliger once again reciting the spell. Hoping I had the words memorized, I attempted the same feat, using the same motions and gestures I would for the fireball spell. Power coursed through me, and ice crystals shot forward at my command. But my aim wasn't as good as Ms. Terwilliger's. Although the spell's structure was similar to that of the fireball, the feel of it was different and required practice. I only managed to take out a few of the Photianas that time, but had more success on my second and third attempts. Whenever I paused to recast, they wasted no chance to come at me, causing more irritation and pain. I would wave them off and cast the spell again, gradually picking off their numbers. I lost track of time until I caught sight of a second cluster of ice crystals joining mine as I sent them into the significantly smaller Photiana flock. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Ms. Terwilliger waving her hands. A moment later, Eddie came striding forward as well, still wielding that sign. They'd both defeated their respective swarms. Mine was the only one left, and within minutes, my friends helped me finish off the last of them. Without the buzzing, the room suddenly took on an eerie silence. We all stood still, chests rising and falling heavily, as we looked around the dim room for any further signs of danger. Eddie and Ms. Terwilliger's faces both showed cuts and scrapes where the Photionis had touched them, and from the stinging of my own skin, I assumed I looked the same. We were alive, though, and the threat seemed to be neutralized for now.
"Where's the envelope?"
Eddie asked at last. I hurried over to where I'd dropped it, back by the raptor bot, who had just surveyed our altercation from his lofty display. The ice crystals had melted into puddles on the floor, and one corner of the envelope was soaked as a result. Otherwise, it seemed undamaged. I carried it over to my friends and turned to Ms. Terwilliger before opening it.
"Do you sense anything?"
I asked.
"If there's a spell, it's very cleverly concealed."
She held up her hand and a small burst of fire appeared in her palm.
"I'll be ready, just in case."
The envelope was heavy and bulky, so I wasn't entirely surprised when I found a brick inside, even though I had no clue what its purpose could be. It appeared to be made out of some sort of sandstone. I glanced at my companions to see if it made sense to them, but they looked as puzzled as I felt. I reached back into the envelope and pulled out a map of the Missouri Ozarks.
"I really didn't expect that," I remarked, scanning it for any writing or clues.
There were none. Anger filled Eddie's features, laced with something I felt too. Disappointment. I hadn't known what we'd discover here, but there'd been a secret part of me that had hoped for a miracle and that we'd find Jill herself. Instead, all we had to show for this trip were some cuts and more cryptic clues. I shook the envelope. It felt empty.
"What on earth could this mean?"
mused Ms. Terwilliger, taking the map from me.
"It means someone's playing with us,"
growled Eddie. He wiped a hand over his sweaty forehead, smearing blood in the process.
"For all we know, Jill isn't even involved in this, and someone's just making us think they have her."
I peered inside the envelope, and my heart sank when I realized it wasn't empty after all.
"I'm afraid not."
I reached into it and pulled out the envelope's last item. Even in the poor lighting, there was no mistaking what this was. A lock of long, curling, light brown hair. And there was no question to whom it belonged.
"Whoever's doing this, they definitely have Jill."
Chapter 5. Adrian. It took every bit of my already questionable self-control not to constantly text and call Sydney for updates. I hadn't realized how hard her absence would hit me. It wasn't just missing her, though that was certainly part of it. I'd gotten used to waking up to her every morning, to seeing her around for meals and other ordinary parts of life. Now, I didn't just have to pass the time without her. I had to also constantly reassure myself that she wasn't in the clutches of the alchemists. "I shouldn't have let her go alone," I told my mom the next day. She glanced up from her cross-stitching. It was a hobby she'd taken up to pass the time, and was only slightly less astonishing than everything else going on in our lives recently. "You worry too much, darling. If there's one thing I can say about my human daughter-in-law, it's that she's shockingly resourceful." I stopped my pacing. "You really think so?" A wry smile played over my mom's lips. "Are you surprised that I'd have something nice to say about her?" "A little, yeah," I admitted. My mother had never openly protested my relationship with Sydney. Really, there'd been no chance. I'd simply shown up at court with a bride in tow, and no one had been able to put asunder those whom the state of Nevada had brought together. My mom hadn't exactly embraced Sydney with open arms, but she'd also stood with us when others, including my own father, had turned their backs on us. I'd always assumed my mom didn't approve, but was simply making the best of a bad situation. I'd be lying if I said that I'd ever, at any point in my life, wished for you to marry a human, she said after a moment of consideration. I do, however, know that the road you walk in life isn't an easy one. It never has been. It never will be. I've realized that since you were a child, and I've also known that whomever you end up with would have to be someone very special, someone capable of facing those challenges with you. This girl, Sydney, she's someone like that. I've gathered that much in this last month, and I'd rather you have a worthy partner who's a human than a Maroi who can't help you share your burdens. My jaw nearly hit the floor. Mom, I think that's the most sentimental thing I've ever heard you say. Hush, she said, and stop worrying. She's competent and talented. And she's not alone. She's got a guardian and that strange human woman with her. I managed a faint smile, but couldn't bring myself to tell my mom that Sydney, no matter how competent and talented, hadn't been able to elude the alchemists before. In fact, when she'd initially been captured, Eddie had been with her. He'd been deadly and fierce as usual, but it hadn't been enough. A knock at the door saved me from further rumination, but presented a host of other new problems. I'd promised Nina we could go looking for Olive later, but that was still a few hours away. Sonia had assured me the sedative she'd given Nina to help her sleep would last a while, but for all I knew, it had worn off and I'd find Nina outside my door with those crazy eyes, demanding we go dreaming right now. But when I opened the door, it was Rose I found instead. I wasn't sure whether to feel relieved or be on my guard. Last I'd known, she'd been away from court. Hey, I said. What's up? She was clearly off duty now, dressed casually in jeans and a t-shirt as opposed to the black and white suits guardians wore for formal occasions. She tossed her mane of dark brown hair over one shoulder and grinned. I heard how you've been locked away up here, so I thought I'd come spring you guys. I tried not to wince at you guys. I thought you and Dimitri were away looking for Jill, I said, hoping to deflect the attention off of us. Some of her enthusiasm dimmed at that. We were, but we weren't having much luck. So Lyssa had us come back and look into a few royals who've always been against her in case they might have abducted Jill. That was news. You think there's any truth to it? Probably not, said Rose. And Lyssa knows it's a long shot, too, but she wants to exhaust every lead. I stepped back. Well, I don't want to hold you up from that. Her grin returned. You aren't. We already put in some hours today and can't do anything else until one of the lords in question gets back tomorrow. So now we're doing something else productive. Grab Sydney, and I'll show you. She's, asleep right now, I lied. Asleep? It's the middle of the day. Our day, I corrected. She's still on a human schedule. Rose looked understandably floored. Really? Last time I was here, I thought she'd adapted pretty nicely. She misses the sun, I explained. Does she actually go out? Well, no, but it's the principle of the matter. It's a human thing. Judging from Rose's increasingly baffled expression, I really wasn't doing a good job of covering for us here, so I decided to cut my losses. Look, why don't you show me whatever you've got and I'll leave a note for Sydney? I figured that was better than Rose possibly offering to wait around until Sydney woke up. Sure, said Rose. We can get her out another time. I gestured her toward the hallway. After you. Don't you need to leave the note? She asked pointedly. Right. Hang on. I stepped back inside and left Rose out in the hall. After standing there for about half a minute, I opened the door again and joined her. All set? Rose took me to a section of court generally reserved for guardian activities. It was near their headquarters and some of their housing. More importantly, it was where they trained, and it was to one of their training fields she led me now. Only, when we arrived, it wasn't a group of Dompiers we found. It was a group of warrior Maroi. Well, I'll be damned, I said. I meant it as a compliment. Ages ago, during the time humans and Maroi had intermarried, Maroi had also done a lot of their own self-defense. They'd used elemental magic as a weapon, fighting the Strigoi themselves. Over time, Dompiers had taken over protective duties, and using magic for anything more than parlor tricks had become taboo among the Maroi. Among many of the other changes recently suggested in Maroi politics, Taking on self-defense once more with magical means often came up for discussion. Now I was seeing it implemented. There were about 24 Moroi here now, divided into 4 groups, each wearing a different color. They were doing drills that could have come straight out of Malachi Wolf's school, defensive maneuvers and hand-to-hand combat. A couple of guardians were advising them, and one I immediately recognized, even with his back to me, thanks to his height and brown leather duster. Dmitri Belikov strode over, offering his hand to me in greeting.
"Adrian," he said warmly, "we don't have a spirit cadre yet. Would you like to lead one? Find some recruits?"
The first person who came to mind was Nina, who was already potentially losing her mind from spirit use. The thought of leading her into combat was discomforting.
"Finally, a leadership role for you," remarked Aunt Tatiana.
I shook my head. "Thanks, but no thanks. I've already got plenty on my plate."
"Where's Sydney?" he asked. "I thought she'd like to see this."
"She's asleep,"
said Rose helpfully. Seeing Dimitri's surprise, I explained, "She's on a human schedule, but you're right. She would have liked to see this. Another time."
"Another time," agreed Dimitri. "Look, they're about to start."
"Start what?" I asked. A guardian I didn't know had just finished setting up some practice dummies on one end of the field. He called each group up, and I watched in amazement as each one demonstrated just how deadly the elements could be. Water users sent high-powered blasts of water at their dummies, knocking them over in one blow. Earth users made the ground unstable and also called upon rocks and dirt as weapons. Air users called up blasts of wind that would have knocked a live opponent over. Some of them were even able to use air to lift objects as weapons. And fire users, well, their destructive ability was pretty obvious as one of the dummies completely went up in flames.
"Just a demo, please," called the guardian wearily. "We don't need to wipe out our supply of dummies yet."
"Sorry,"
called a cheerful voice I recognized. Christian Ozera was standing there among the red-clad fire users, and he vanquished the flames with a glance. After the separate demonstrations of elemental power, the warriors then showed how they might use the elements together. Air users helped freeze water summoned by water users. Earth users trapped dummies in the ground, letting fire users swoop in for the kill. This resulted in another near destruction of a dummy when Christian again got too zealous with his flames.
"Sorry,"
he repeated, not sounding sorry in the least. Finally, they concluded with a demonstration of the hand-to-hand maneuvers I'd seen them practicing when I arrived. Moroi weren't as physically strong as Dampiers, but it was clear this group had put in a lot of training. I wouldn't have wanted to go up against any of them in a fight. They demonstrated moves any guardian would have been proud to master, and even showed how to work in elemental attacks. All in all, it was a stunning display.
"Well?"
demanded Christian afterward. He came striding over to us on the sidelines when the display finished.
"Think that'll win them over?"
A small blonde girl in blue walked beside him, and I was pleased, though not surprised, that Mia Rinaldi was a leader among the water users.
"That was flawless," she agreed. "There's no way they can't approve a program now."
"What are you talking about?" I asked.
"This was just a warm-up," Christian explained. "No pun intended. We're going to show this to the Moroi Council in the hopes they'll approve a program we can take to all the Moroi schools, in order to recruit and train more people for the cause."
Mia's blue eyes gleamed. "We also want to get approval to launch some private Strigoi hunting parties."
"Well, you'd have my vote," I said honestly. "You seem like you might put the Guardians out of business."
"Let's not get carried away," teased Rose. "But you're right. They've come a long way. Now we just have to get the Council to agree. Lys is already on board."
"Of course she is," I said, "because she's young and progressive. The others might be more resistant to change, even with a display as impressive as this."
Rose nodded, perfectly understanding how even the most well-intentioned Moroi clung to tradition.
I'd hoped Sydney might have some logical arguments we could use to plead our case.
I chuckled at that.
"I'm sure she would."
"Where is Sydney, anyway?"
asked Christian. "Asleep," Rose and I said in unison. As fascinating as these Moroi warriors were, I feared more questions about Sydney were coming my way. That and a glance at my watch told me it'd soon be time to go dreamwalking with Nina.
"I should head back," I said. "Thanks for letting me see this."
"Happy to," said Rose,
steering me back toward the main part of court. Find out what would be a good day for Sydney, and we'll set this up again, at a more human-friendly time. I gritted my teeth, hating the lies. I'll talk to her and get back to you. Rose walked me back, and I could tell she thought it was strange that I made a point of keeping her out of the suite. I blamed it on Sydney being a light sleeper, which Rose mostly seemed to accept. When she finally left, I found the excitement of the demo and the further deepening of lies had me restless and uneasy, making it difficult to fall asleep when I crawled into bed. It was also the middle of the vampiric day for me, further muddling things, but Nina had said Olive was on a human schedule, so she would be asleep now. When 30 minutes went by of tossing and turning in bed, I received a text from Nina saying she couldn't reach me in a dream. Having trouble sleeping, I wrote back. I've got plenty of sedatives from Sonia if you need one, came the joking response. Happy to share. I smiled, wistful for a moment of the easy friendship I used to have with Nina. No thanks. Just give me a little more time. Eventually, I managed to relax and drift off to sleep on my own. It had been a while since any spirit user pulled me into a dream. Usually, I was the dream's creator, calling the shots and inviting others to join me with spirit's power. My surroundings materialized around me, solidifying into a pastoral setting in front of a cute white house. Beyond it, a fence enclosed a pasture where horses idly grazed in the purple and orange light of a setting sun. Birds sang evening songs, and a warm breeze brushed my skin. My dad's house in Wisconsin, a voice behind me said. I turned and found Nina approaching me through the long grass of the house's front yard. She looked a million times better than the last time I'd seen her, with her curly hair pulled into a loose bun and a lavender sundress on her slim frame. I hoped this reflected some improvement in the waking world and wasn't simply an illusion of the dream. It's nice, I said honestly. The kind of place kids dream of growing up. She smiled at that. We could only come in the summer. We had some family friends who were minor royals, and they'd join us with their guardians. Otherwise, it would have been too dangerous out here. It's pretty remote, but you never know. She didn't have to finish that thought. Nina and Olive were half-sisters, sharing their Moroi father. Because he wasn't royal, he'd received no guardian protection, so Dompierre Olive had made herself his protection, and gotten herself turned Strigoi during an attack. Nina's spirit magic had brought her back. It was a rare distinction Olive shared with only a couple of others, Dimitri and Sonia, to be precise. "Shall we bring Olive here?" I asked, not wanting Nina to dwell on ugly topics from the past. At my question, though, her frown grew. "It's not quite that simple. You'll see. I mean, maybe it'll be different with you here. I hope so." I still didn't entirely understand what the problem was, but decided to wait and see what happened. Really, if Olive was asleep, this should have been a piece of cake. Nina should have been able to use spirit to bring Olive to this country house, just as she'd brought me. Nina grew still, gazing off at the horse pasture, and I sensed the spirit magic welling up in her as she attempted a dream connection with her sister. So far, so good. A few moments later, a translucent form started to materialize near us. I recognized Olive's shorter stance, her dark hair and coppery skin. A billowing cloak swirled around her, obscuring what I knew was a more muscular build than her sister's. Olive's eyes widened as she realized what was happening. "No, Nina, please, not again!" Normally, this would be the point where Olive would have completely solidified and been standing with us. Instead, the country scenery began to fade in the distance, growing increasingly insubstantial. I jerked my gaze back to Nina. "What are you doing?" She sighed. "I'm not doing anything. That's what I've been trying to tell you." The beautiful green landscape disappeared, replaced by a black, ashen terrain that was dotted with rocks. A jagged mountainside rose steeply before us, climbing into a sky growing gray with thunderclouds. Occasional flashes of lightning danced between the clouds. There was no sign of Olive. "What is this?" I exclaimed. "Did we get transported into a dystopian movie?" Nina's expression was grim. "We're in Hawaii." I glanced around. "I hate to disagree, but when I think Hawaii, I think palm trees and bikinis." Nina glanced down at her feet,
and a moment later her sandals transformed into sneakers. She began hiking up the slope. It's a volcano we visited when we were kids on vacation.
That doesn't seem so bad, I said, cautiously following her. But why change it? The farm was nice.
I didn't change it, she said, clearly frustrated. Olive did.
Olive's not a spirit user, I protested.
She can change her outfit, yeah, but not something this big.
Somehow she took control of the dream from me. She does it every time. I mean, I can do small things like this.
She paused to gesture to her shoes.
But I can't send us back or bring Olive out.
Where is she?
Hiding somewhere.
Nina scanned around and pointed to a dark hole in the volcano's side.
Probably there. That wasn't part of the real volcano we saw. She must have created it.
My mind was reeling as I approached the cave with her. What she was saying was impossible. Olive couldn't have power in this dream unless Nina ceded it to her.
How? I asked. How is she doing this?
Do you think it has something to do with her being restored from being a Strigoi? From being infused with spirit?
Nina shook her head.
I don't think so. I don't actually feel her using spirit. It's almost like she's controlling it by her will.
I tried to wrap my head around that as we came to a halt in front of the cave.
Now what?
Now? Said Nina. She's probably hiding from us in there. But if it's like other places she has brought me to in dreams, we probably can't just walk in and...
A roar from within the cave's depths cut off her words. Instinctively, I took a few steps back.
What the hell is that?
Nina looked more weary than frightened.
I don't know, something terrible. Something to scare us off.
Her words were realized as a huge, man-like figure made of black rocks came lumbering out of the cave, its eyes burning red. It was a full head taller than me, and twice as broad. It came to a halt before us, beat its chest, and let out another roar.
Have you seen this before?
I exclaimed.
Not exactly, said Nina. Last time she sent a swarm of bats. Before that it was some kind of werewolf creature.
You made this dream, I insisted, backing up further as the lava monster, for lack of a better term, approached.
Get rid of it.
I can't, not with my thoughts at least. We have to do this the old-fashioned way. I felt spirit magic surge within her again, and a cudgel appeared in her hands. Without further warning, she charged forward and swung the weapon at the monster. As she did, I felt more spirit flare inside her. In fact, it was the spirit magic that seemed to lash out at the monster, more than the cudgel. The creature roared in pain, and cracks appeared where the cudgel hit.
You said you'd help me! She yelled, clearly annoyed.
I had said that, but I certainly hadn't expected it to be in this manner. Before I signed on for senseless beating, though, I summoned my own magic and attempted to change the setting into something more hospitable. But when I tried it, I met firm resistance and understood better what Nina had meant. It wasn't exactly spirit I felt keeping the dream in place, but very much like will or intention, just as she'd said. Unable to alter the dream's larger context, I imitated her and used a small burst of spirit to create a cudgel of my own. I wasn't usually violent in nature, and as I swung toward the lava monster, on which Nina had made significant progress, I reminded myself that he was just a dream creation and not a real living thing. When my cudgel struck the creature's stony hide, I nearly fell backward at the jolt of the impact. It rattled my bones and teeth, and didn't seem to make a difference to the lava monster. Nina paused to glare at me.
You need to fill yourself up with spirit when you hit it, she explained in frustration. That's the way to fight through.
She was certainly practicing what she preached. Brimming with magic, she was like a spirit torch beside me, and I was a bit taken aback by the amount she was wielding. It wasn't quite as severe as the burst used in restoring a Strigoi or bringing back the dead, but it was a notable amount to be holding and sustaining over an extended period of time. Reluctantly, I summoned some of my own, not nearly the amount she was using, and used it to blast the creature when I swung my cudgel. This time, I too cracked the surface.
More! More! Nina cried.
There's no need, I said. This still has impact, without as much magic.
It just takes a little longer. We don't have the time!
I didn't understand what she meant until our collective efforts finally defeated the lava monster, and it crumbled to dust before us. Nina sprinted into the cave, and with the creature gone, she seemed to have regained control of the dream. The setting around us changed, and suddenly we were running into the white country house in Wisconsin. I just barely caught sight of Olive in the shadowy corner of a living room, her body obscured by that same billowing cloak from earlier.
"Olive!" screamed Nina. "Show me where you are!"
More power surged through her, and the room started to flicker. I could feel a little of what she was doing, and I was astonished. She was trying to make the dream reflect Olive's surroundings, something even I hadn't known was possible. But Olive was fading before our eyes.
"I'm sorry, Nina. Please, please stop trying to find me. It's better this way." "Olive!"
It was too late. Olive faded, and the room stopped flickering. It stabilized, firmly remaining a little country living room, and offering no clues as to where Olive was. Defeated, Nina slumped into a wicker chair, tears in her eyes.
"She woke herself up. That's what happens every time. She throws up some obstacle for me to fight against, and it distracts me from making the dream show where she's at. By the time I fight through, she's managed to wake herself and escape from the dream."
Nina turned her gaze on me accusingly.
"If we defeated her faster, she wouldn't have had time to wake up. You should have used more spirit to blast that monster away."
Nina, though obviously upset, looked mostly stable here in the dream world. Thinking back to the other day, however, I knew her real world self was another matter.
"I don't think that's a good idea," I said slowly.
"I think using all this spirit has been having a, detrimental effect on you over time.
If you'd help me, really help me, we'd only have to do it once. If we can corner her, we can make the dream show us where she's at."
"Yeah, about that," I said, sitting beside her.
"Where'd you learn to do that? Make the dream show where she's at?"
That would have been incredibly useful when I'd been trying to find Sydney. Nina shrugged.
"You can make a person appear as they are in real life, right? I was experimenting one day and channeled the spirit through her in a way that made the dream setting simply mirror the place she was in."
"I'm not sure simply is the word I'd use," I remarked. "That involved a lot of spirit, too. And I wonder, did she start controlling the dream afterward? Did you inadvertently give her control?" It was obvious Nina hadn't thought of that.
I don't know. Maybe I did, but how else am I supposed to find out where she is?"
"Try talking to her," I suggested. She slammed her fist on the wicker armrest.
"I have! She won't see me. This is the only way. Something's wrong, and we need to find out what. We need to try again. Only next time..."
Whoa, there can't be a next time," I warned.
"You'll burn yourself out. You've done this every day for how long?"
Her gaze grew distant.
"I don't know. Months?"
I winced. No wonder she was losing it.
"No more spirit."
She looked up at me, her gaze pleading.
"I have to. Can't you understand that? Do you know what it's like to not know what's happened to someone you care so much about?"
"Jill," I thought, with a pang. Nina must have seen something in my expression because she suddenly lit up.
"Help me. Help me, Adrian, and together we'll have enough spirit to overcome her. I can stop doing this every day. I'll find out what's happened to her. Please."
I thought of Sonia's worries for Nina. Then I thought of Sydney, cautioning me to be careful with spirit. I'd be in enough trouble already if she found out about this burst of spirit use. I slowly shook my head. "I can't. I shouldn't have even done this."
"If we work together, it won't require as much from either of us," Nina begged. "Please help me. I'll help you in return. Is there anything you need? Help me find Olive and I'll do anything."
I started to shake my head again, then paused as an idea hit me. "No," I said, more to myself than her. "No." She jumped to her feet.
"There is something, isn't there? Tell me!"
I hesitated,
knowing I really shouldn't be going down this path. But her offer of help had made me think of one thing I did want very badly, getting back to Sydney. I need to sneak out of court without anyone knowing, and then I need to make people think I'm still here, back with my mom. Done, said Nina. I can do that. Easy. Nina, look, she said. I can help you right now, right this minute, get you out of court. It'd be an easy compulsion spell. Then you can meet me in a dream to find Olive wherever you are. That's nice of you, I said wearily, but that's not going to convince people I'm still living here. A mischievous smile crossed her lips. I can do that too. If your mom will let me stay with her, I'll compel anyone who comes looking for you into thinking they saw you. I'll make the workers at guest housing think they see you coming and going. No one will suspect a thing. Please, Adrian. She squeezed my hand. Let's help each other. I took my hand back, unwilling to admit how tempted I was. She was offering me the only shot I had at joining Sydney, something I wanted badly enough to consider ignoring all warnings about spirit use. But how could I subject either of us to more magic? Especially her. It was selfish. It's too dangerous, I told her. I don't care, she said obstinately. I'll just keep trying whether you help me or not. Olive is everything to me. And Sydney's everything to me, I thought. Desperately, I tried to find a way to reconcile the guilt I felt about taking Nina's help. She'd said she'd keep going after Olive, right? Well, if I helped her find Olive and made her stop, it'd result in Nina actually using less spirit. That was a good thing, right? I took a deep breath and looked her squarely in the eyes. If we try this again, let me wield the bulk of the spirit. But we both will, I said, and we're only doing it once, not every day. If I do the heavy lifting once, it won't affect me as badly. You augment, a little, but that's it. You can't keep hurting yourself. She reached her hand toward mine again, then drew it back, though her expression had softened. You do care about me, don't you? I knew it. Even though you're married... Nina, I said firmly, it's not like that. I care about you, but I love Sydney. And if we're going to do this again, we're doing it my way. Her eyes remained dreamy a few moments longer, and then she gave a reluctant nod. Your way, she reiterated, and I really will help you. I'm counting on it, I admitted. But hopefully you can pull off what we need using as little spirit as possible. She gave a meek nod and then turned curious. Okay, but are you sure you aren't worried about your sanity in all of this? I hesitated. If Sydney were here, I knew she'd tell me this was foolish, that I was frivolously using spirit I didn't need to and possibly damaging myself. But there was no way I could abandon Nina to insanity, especially if there really was something wrong with Olive. And I certainly had to seize a chance to get out in the world to help both Sydney and Jill. I just hoped what I'd told Nina earlier, that a one-time use wouldn't hurt me, would prove true. I managed a stiff smile. Hey, I'm not showing any signs of insanity yet, I told her. I'm sure I'll be fine. Me too, whispered Aunt Tatiana. I'm sure you'll be fine too.
Chapter 6 Sydney. We had no idea what the sandstone brick meant. There was no enchantment that we could detect on it, no indication of what its role in this mystery was. The only thing we knew for sure was that we needed to get to the Ozarks, or at the very least, Missouri. Once Mr. Williger had settled things with her rental car company to prolong her lease, she suggested we drive to St. Louis and then make a plan of attack. Instantly, my stomach sank. Not there, I said swiftly. There's an alchemist facility in St. Louis. I didn't go to all this trouble just to walk right back into their hands. Eddie's eyebrows rose in consideration.
Maybe that's part of the plan. What if this scavenger hunt is part of an alchemist plot to lure you out and has nothing to do with Jill at all?
It was a sobering thought, one made more alarming when Mr. Williger suggested,
Or what if it does have to do with Jill? There is the lock of hair, after all, which certainly looks like Jill's. Would the alchemists have taken her as a way to trap you? For a moment, I dared give the idea credence. Jill was taken right when Adrian and I had managed to escape and hide at court. The alchemists were among the few people who knew Jill's location, so they could have easily sent someone after her. I pondered the possibility and analyzed it every way I could with lingering alchemist logic. At last, I shook my head. "I don't think so," I said. "They might have had the means, but not the motivation. The alchemists are guilty of a lot of things, but they don't want the Moroi turning on each other, which would happen with the death of a royal princess, one whose life influenced the throne. I also can't see the alchemists resorting to human magic, even to get to me. It goes against too much of their doctrine." Even if this wasn't some elaborate alchemist trap, I still didn't want to risk walking into an alchemist on their lunch break in St. Louis. With that in mind, we set a new destination. It took an entire day of driving, but we finally called a halt the following night in Jefferson City, Missouri, putting us well past St. Louis. It also positioned us toward the Ozarks in a slightly out-of-the-way trajectory that we hoped might throw off someone waiting for our approach. Of course, we still didn't know exactly where we were going. The Ozarks consisted of a very large expanse of land, and thus far, our brick hadn't yielded any clues. We went out to dinner after checking into a hotel, all three of us weary in that way you got from sitting in a car all day. It was nearing midnight, but we'd skipped dinner in order to make better driving time. I was tired more than anything else, with food simply being a formality. Across the table, Mr. Wilker stifled a yawn, and even Eddie, despite his perpetual vigilance, seemed like he was looking forward to bed as well. We had the brick sitting on our table as we waited for our food to arrive, all of us staring at it, as though we could make it yield some answers through sheer force of will. I finally dragged my gaze away from it and glanced at my cell phone, hoping I'd missed a text from Adrian in response to one I'd sent earlier with our status. There had been little communication from him throughout the day, which seemed odd after yesterday, when he'd sent almost constant updates. I knew it was unreasonable to expect him to do nothing except sit by the phone to talk to me, but I couldn't shake the difference. After the troubling way things had been between us this last month, I found myself getting caught up in weird fits of paranoia, thinking that maybe once the shock of having me gone was over, Adrian found he kind of liked the freedom. The waitress arrived with our food just then, and I tucked the phone back into my purse. As she set down our plates, her breath caught at the sight of the sandstone brick. "Did you guys steal that from Haha Tonka?" We stared at her as though she were speaking another language. "I mean, that's cool if you did," she added hastily, unnerved by our silence. "It's a sweet place. I see lots of people going to and from there. Wouldn't mind a souvenir myself." Ms. Terwilliger recovered herself first. "Can you say that name again? Haha Wonka?" "Haha Tonka," the girl corrected. She glanced between our faces. "You really haven't been there? That brick looks just like the one the ruins are made of. You should check it out if you're going into the Ozarks." The instant she was gone, I looked up Haha Tonka on my phone. "No way," I said. "There's a castle in Missouri."
"Do you think Jill's being held there?"
Eddie asked, eyes aglow. I could already tell he was envisioning himself rescuing her from some tall tower, possibly battling a dragon or a robot dinosaur in the process. "Not likely. She was right about the ruins part." I showed them a picture of Haha Tonka, which was an impressive structure despite having seen better days. It had no roof, and some sections of the walls were gone, making it all open air and easy to walk through. The building was technically a mansion, not a castle,
and the whole area had been turned into a state park full of trails and other natural attractions. If Jill was there, it wasn't obvious where she could be held captive. But at least we had a destination now, because the waitress was right about one thing. Our brick looked exactly like those from the ruins. The new knowledge reinvigorated us, and we nearly forgot our food as we began making plans. According to the park's website, it opened at 7 in the morning. We decided to get there as soon as we could get in and do some preliminary scouting. If there was a chance we might have some showdown akin to what we'd faced at the Robot Museum, then we'd go to the trouble of sneaking in after hours. With the way this weird scavenger hunt was unfolding, there was really no telling what we might be facing or what the person running it expected of us. We woke up energized the next morning, even after only 5 hours of sleep, eager to get on the road and see what secrets Haha Tonka held. The park was only an hour away, but we stopped at a gas station to fill up the car before getting on the highway. While Eddie took care of refueling, I headed inside the station to make sure Ms. Terwilliger and I had more coffee for the road. As I was approaching the door, I came to a screeching halt when I saw someone familiar inside. My dad. He was standing at the counter, taking money out of his wallet. His body was angled away from me, so he couldn't see me on the other side of the glass door. Yesterday's conversation came back to me, and I suddenly wondered if this really was all some alchemist plot to catch me. For a moment, I was so paralyzed with fear that I couldn't react. Despite the awkwardness of my living situation at the Moroi Court this last month, there was no question that it was a million times better than what I'd faced in re-education. I'd thought that I'd been able to put that awful experience behind me. But as I stood there, staring at my dad's back, I suddenly found it hard to breathe. For all I knew, 50 alchemists were about to spring out from all directions, dragging me back to a tiny dark room and sentencing me to a lifetime of physical and psychological torture. "Move, Sydney, move!" some part of my brain shouted at me. But I couldn't. All I kept thinking about was how the alchemists had overwhelmed me before. And that was with Eddie by my side. What chance did I stand here, all by myself? "Move!" I told myself again. "Stop feeling helpless!" That spurred me to action. I began breathing again and slowly backed away, not wanting to do anything that might catch attention in his periphery. When I couldn't see him anymore, I spun around and prepared to make a mad dash back to the car. Instead, I ran into my sister, Zoe. She'd been walking toward the gas station, and my panic shot back up as I looked at her. Then, as I studied her expression of complete shock, I realized something. I was the last person she'd expected to see here. This wasn't some sort of elaborate trap. At least it hadn't been until I walked into it. "Zoe!" I squeaked. "What are you doing here?" Her eyes were impossibly wide as she attempted her own recovery. "We're on our way to the St. Louis facility. I'm starting an internship there." Last I knew, she'd been in Salt Lake City with my dad, and I couldn't help but pull up a mental road map. This wasn't a direct route between the two places. "Why didn't you take I-70? I demanded suspiciously. "There was construction, and..." She shook her head, almost angrily. "What are you doing here? You're supposed to be stashed away with the Moroi!" Increasing my astonishment, she grabbed my sleeve and began steering me farther from the station. "You have to get out of here!" Cue more astonishment. "Are you helping me?" Before she could answer, I heard Eddie's voice. "Sydney?" It was all he said, but as Zoe and I turned around, I could see the apprehension and battle readiness all over him. He stayed where he was, but looked as though he could instantly leap up and throw Zoe against the building if she tried to hurt me. I really hoped it wouldn't come to that, because no matter what had happened between us, no matter how much she'd betrayed me, she was still my sister. I still loved her. "Is it true?" she whispered. "Do they really torture you in re-education?"
I nodded and cast another anxious glance at the gas station. In more ways than you can imagine. She blanched, but drew a resolved breath.
Then get out of here. Hurry, before he comes out, both of you.
I was stunned at this complete reversal in her behavior, but Eddie didn't need to be told twice. He took hold of my arm and nearly dragged me to the car.
We're going, now, he ordered.
I caught one last glimpse of Zoe before Eddie shoved me in the car, where Ms. Terwilliger sat waiting for us. A thousand emotions played over Zoe's face as we peeled out, but I could only interpret a few. Sadness, longing. As we quickly got back on the road, I found myself shaking. Eddie was driving and kept anxiously checking the rearview mirror.
No sign of pursuit, he said. She must not have been able to see which direction we went to tell him.
I slowly shook my head. No, she didn't tell him at all. She helped us.
Sydney, said Eddie, in a stern but trying to sound kind voice. She's the one who turned you in the first time. The one who started that whole re-education nightmare.
I know, but...
I thought back to Zoe's face just now, looking so serious and upset about the notion of me being tortured. I thought back also to the day Adrian and I had first arrived at court, when we'd been hauled in front of the Queen and found a group of alchemists already waiting there to try to get me back. My father and Ian, another alchemist we knew, had spoken plenty about the wrongness of what I'd done and how I needed to be removed from the Moroi. Zoe had stayed silent, her face stricken, and I'd been too overwhelmed to think much about what she might be feeling. I'd assumed she'd been too outraged by my marriage to speak, not to mention the fact that my dad didn't really let anyone else get a word in edgewise. Now I suddenly realized there might have been something I'd missed altogether. Regret.
I really think she was trying to help,
I insisted, knowing how crazy the words sounded, especially to Eddie. He'd been there the night I was taken, the night she'd betrayed me.
Something's changed.
He didn't contradict me, but was still on edge.
I wonder if we should change our plans, in case they start scouting the area for us.
No, I said firmly, feeling more and more confident of my suspicions. She's not going to turn us in. Unless you see active signs of someone coming after us, we're pushing on to Hahatonka. I was reeling as the drive continued, still in awe at this new revelation that Zoe might be having doubts, if not about the alchemists, then at least about what had been done to me. Once I recovered from my initial shock, I found myself feeling an emotion I hadn't felt about her in a very long time. Hope. Clouds were thinning out when we reached Hahatonka State Park, and the early morning temperatures were already promising a sweltering day ahead. We parked and stopped by the visitor center, clustering around a map of the park. Although there were extensive grounds and trails, we decided the ruins of the massive stone building, which even the park referred to as the castle, were the place to start, seeing as that's what our clue directly connected to. No one else was out this early, aside from the staff at the visitor center. Ms. Terwilliger and I walked around the stone ruins, looking for signs of magic and occasionally casting detection spells. Eddie stayed near us protectively, doing his own searching as well, but mostly relying on us to find whatever it was we were looking for. The part of me that had long loved art and architecture couldn't help but get caught up in the ruined grandeur around us, and I wished Adrian was with me. We hadn't officially had a honeymoon after our wedding, but we'd often talked about all the potential places we'd like to go, if only we had the freedom. Italy was still high on my list, as was Greece, but honestly, I would have gladly settled for Missouri, if only Adrian could be with me, free from pursuit. After a few hours of searching, we were hot and sweaty, but had yielded no results. Eddie, still not convinced of Zoe's intentions, was growing nervous about us lingering and wanted to be on the road soon. As lunchtime neared and we contemplated calling a break, something flashed in my periphery. I turned and looked up at one of the castle's dilapidated towers and saw something small and golden shining in the afternoon sunlight. I touched Eddie's arm and pointed. "What's that gold thing?" He put a hand above his eyes and squinted.
"What gold thing?"
"On the tower there, right below the top window opening." Eddie looked again and then dropped his hand.
"I don't see anything."
I beckoned Ms. Terwilliger over and tried to show her. "Do you see that? Below that window on the tallest tower?"
"It looks golden," she said promptly.
Eddie was incredulous and turned back to where we indicated.
"What are you guys talking about? There's nothing there."
I could understand his disbelief. Dompier vision was superior to that of a human. Ms. Terwilliger scrutinized him for a moment before fixing her gaze back on the tower.
"It's possible we're looking at something that can only be seen by those who perceive magic. This could be what we need."
"Then how do we get to it?" I wondered aloud. The tower itself was little more than a high stone wall, and I wasn't confident it offered great footholds for climbing. It was also in a section of the castle behind a fence, warning visitors to stay on the outside. With a few more tourists wandering through, plus the occasional park ranger, I knew there was no way we could covertly jump the fence. Eddie surprised us both with a magical suggestion.
"I could climb it. Can't you guys do an invisibility spell?"
"Yes," I began. "But it won't do much good if you can't see what you're looking for. I wish I could climb it, but I think it's a bit beyond my abilities."
"Can we both be invisible?"
he asked.
"You stand at the bottom and spot me. Tell me where to go."
Ms. Terwilliger turned Eddie invisible, and I then cast the same spell on myself. It wasn't a particularly strong invisibility spell, and anyone looking for us would be able to detect us. We didn't want to cast a stronger spell in case we had to defend ourselves later, and we were taking it on faith no tourist or ranger was expecting to find someone climbing the ruined walls. Unseen, Eddie and I easily hopped the fence and approached the tower in question. Up close, I now had a better sense for what the golden object was.
"It looks like a brick," I told him.
He followed my gaze, still unable to see what I saw.
"I'll take your word for it."
The tower's surface was rough and irregular, with erratic handholds and other openings left behind for long-gone windows. I wouldn't have been able to climb it, but Eddie managed it deftly, the strong muscles in his body working as he grappled for places to rest feet and hands as he slowly made his way up. When he arrived at the top window, he at least had a place to rest and stand on the opening's edge. Reaching up, he placed his hand on a brick at random.
"Now what?"
"It's 3 bricks to your left and 2 up," I called.
He counted and moved his hand, setting it on what I saw as a golden brick.
"Is this it? It's loose. I can pull it out."
"That's the one."
I tensed as he pried the brick from the wall. I sensed no obvious traps from this distance, but for all I knew, the entire structure would crumble down around us when he removed it. With a little wriggling, it came free. Both Eddie and I froze, waiting for a deadly Photiana swarm or some other disaster. When nothing happened, he tossed the brick to the ground beside me and began scaling his way down. Once he was safely back, we hurried out of the enclosed area and took the brick to Ms. Terwilliger. All 3 of us crowded around it, hoping for revelation but got nothing. We cast more spells on it and tried pairing it with the original brick we'd brought from Pittsburgh. Still nothing. Wondering if there might be more gold bricks around, we did another search of the property but came up empty. Hot and hungry by this point, we decided to call a break and get some lunch. We went to a German restaurant and were surprised to see how crowded it and other restaurants in the park's small town were.
"There's a fishing convention in town," our waiter told us.
"Hope you've got a hotel if you were planning on staying."
We hadn't gotten one yet, actually, though we had been discussing staying overnight to possibly search the park again tomorrow. "Maybe we can find another nearby town," I mused. The waiter brightened.
"My uncle runs a campground that has vacancies right now. He'll even rent tents and everything. Cheaper than a hotel."
Cost wasn't an issue, but after a brief discussion, we decided to follow up on the offer and go out to the campground, simply because of its proximity to the park. We were able to rent what we needed, get set up, and then make another trip to Haha Tonka before it closed for the night. Once more, we found no answers in either the park or the brick. We tried to tell ourselves that morning would bring fresh perspective, but none of us would give voice to the burning question hanging between us. What were we going to do if we weren't able to find the gold brick's secrets? I longed to discuss it with Adrian, but there'd still been no communication since my last update. Dutifully, I sent him another report about what was going on and then prepared for bed, unwilling to admit how much his radio silence bothered me. Exhausted from a long day, I soon fell asleep in the rented tent and was awakened a few hours later by a panicked Eddie.
"Sydney! Jackie! Get up!"
I opened my eyes and instantly sat upright. "What? What is it?" He was standing in the unzipped opening of the tent, pointing outward. Mr. Williger and I scrambled to his side and looked where he indicated. There, out in the moonlight, a glowing puddle of what seemed like molten gold was oozing over the ground, coming toward us. Where it touched, it left scorched grass and earth behind.
"What is that?" I exclaimed.
"The brick," said Eddie. "I was on watch inside and noticed it starting to glow. I picked it up, and it nearly burned my hand. I threw it outside, and it melted into that."
Mr. Williger murmured a quick incantation as the blob nearly reached our tent. An invisible wave of power shot out and knocked the golden glob back a few feet. Then it began making its way back toward us.
"Wonderful," I muttered.
She repeated the spell, but it was clear that was only a temporary fix.
"Can we trap it?" I asked. "There are a lot of stones around. We could make some kind of enclosure."
"It's burning right through the stones in its path," said Eddie grimly.
Mr. Williger gave up on the force spells and cast a freezing spell similar to what she'd used in the robot museum. She directed a blast of bitter cold toward the molten puddle, which halted in its tracks. Half of the blob began to solidify, though the other half was still liquid and mobile and tried to wriggle away, dragging its frozen half with it.
"Sydney, get to the other side,"
Mr. Williger said. I hurried to obey, running out of the tent and standing on the other side of the blob, which had liquefied now that she'd momentarily dropped the spell. The ooze moved toward the tent again, and Mr. Williger held up her hands to cast.
"On the count of three," she ordered. 1, 2, 3!
Simultaneously, we released freezing spells, attacking the molten gold from opposite sides. The mass wriggled and writhed in the grip of the magic, but slowly began to solidify. I'd never sustained the spell for a long time, but Mr. Williger wasn't letting go of the magic. I followed her lead until, at last, the gold was still, completely solidified into an irregularly shaped puddle. We let go of the magic and carefully walked up to it. The gold stayed as it was.
"That was weird," I said. "Not quite as bad as the last attack."
I still had a few cuts from the little magical fireflies that had come after us in Pittsburgh.
"Only because it didn't get to us," warned Mr. Williger.
"I hate to think what would have happened if we'd all been asleep in that tent when it liquefied."
I shuddered, knowing she was right. "But what does it mean?" No one had an immediate answer, but Eddie surprised us when he spoke a few seconds later.
I've seen this before.
A golden brick that turned into a deadly, rampaging puddle of molten metal? I asked. He shot me a wan smile.
No. Look at that shape. Doesn't it seem familiar?
I tilted my head to study the golden form before us. There didn't seem to be any design to the shape. It was an amorphous, vaguely ovalish shape that looked like it had hardened that way by coincidence. Eddie's intense look of concentration said he believed otherwise. After a few more moments of concentration, revelation lit his features. He pulled out his cell phone and tapped in something. With shoddy coverage in the park, it took a little while for the phone to find what Eddie needed, but when it did, he was triumphant.
There, take a look.
Ms. Terwilliger and I peered at his screen and found a map of the greater Palm Springs area. Instantly, I realized what he'd tuned into.
It's the Salton Sea, I breathed.
Good recall, Eddie. The Salton Sea was a saline lake outside of Palm Springs, and the metal puddle before us was exactly the same shape as that body of water. Ms. Terwilliger shook her head and gave a snort of dismay.
Wonderful. I left Palm Springs to warn you, got caught up in a magical scavenger hunt, and am now, after all that effort, simply taking you back home. But why?
Asked Eddie.
Has Jill been there the whole time? And who's the one pulling the strings behind all... Get back!
Cried Ms. Terwilliger, holding her hands in a warding gesture. Not even Eddie could move fast enough from what she'd spotted. The golden blob had begun to tremble, like it was suddenly filled with energy that needed to get out. I tried to cast a shielding spell, but even as the words formed on my lips, I knew I wasn't going to be fast enough. The blob exploded into 100 little golden razor blades that came flying toward us, and then stopped. They hit an invisible barrier and fell harmlessly to the ground. I stared at where they lay, my heart pounding as I thought of the terrible damage they would have caused if Ms. Terwilliger hadn't been fast enough. So it was a surprise to me when she said,
Excellent reflexes, Sydney. I couldn't manage it in time.
I jerked my gaze up from the blades. You didn't cast that? She frowned.
No, I thought you did. I did,
a voice behind us said. I spun around and gasped as, incredibly, Adrian emerged from the trees. Forgetting the tragedy that had nearly taken place, I ran into his arms, letting him lift me off my feet.
What are you doing here? I exclaimed.
Never mind. I kissed him hard, so overwhelmed that I didn't even care that Eddie and Ms. Terwilliger were nearby. Being away from him these last couple of days had made my heart ache more than I'd expected. And I think we were both surprised when he was the one who finally broke the kiss off.
I told you I'd find a way to get here, he said, grinning.
His gaze fell on the blades, and his smile faded.
Not a moment too soon, I guess.
With his arm still around me, I turned back to the razors, which glittered ominously in the grass. A memory slowly surfaced within me.
I've seen those before, I said, sounding much like Eddie had earlier.
Ms. Terwilliger exhaled a shaking breath.
It's a nasty spell, not one to be cast lightly.
I know, I said softly. I cast it once. Everyone turned to me in astonishment.
When?
She asked.
Where?
At your house. Your old house before it burned down. I corrected. 1,000 memories crushed down on me, and the world swayed a little as I suddenly made connection after connection. I thought I didn't know anyone capable of using this kind of human magic. Anyone who'd want to come after me, at least. I'd been wrong. I met my friend's expectant gazes.
It's the spell I used to kill Alicia, I explained.
Chapter 7. Adrian. Alicia DeGraw was alive. It was shocking to me, so I could only imagine how Sydney must feel. She'd thought she'd killed Alicia. Alicia had been the apprentice of Jackie's sister, Veronica, but had gone rogue. That was no small thing, seeing as Veronica herself was certainly no role model. She'd been obsessed with stealing youth and power from other witches, effectively leaving them in comas for the rest of their lives. Alicia had turned on her mentor, taken her power, and then gone after Jackie. Sydney and I had been involved in a showdown at Jackie's house at the end of last year, a showdown that had resulted in said house burning to the ground. We hadn't known for sure if Alicia had made it out, but now we had our answer. "I'm kind of torn," Sydney admitted, stirring the coffee she had yet to drink. We'd left the campground to go discuss matters in a 24-hour restaurant, and it was a sign of her worry that the coffee was untouched. I was pretty sure I'd never seen her pass on caffeine in all our time together. Part of me's relieved I didn't actually kill someone. On the other hand, well, this kind of complicates things.
"You're certain?" Jackie asked from across the table. "Those are the same ones?"
Sydney held up a golden razor blade, the only one she'd saved from the campsite. The rest had been destroyed. "Positive. You don't forget something like that. That night I fought her, I transformed some perpetual motion balls into blades just like these."
"I remember those," Jackie murmured, almost wistfully. "They were an end-of-the-year gift from a former student. I think he hoped I'd raise his grade."
Sydney seemed not to have heard. There was a haunted look in her eyes.
"I sent the blades toward Alicia. It was just instinct. She fell down your basement stairs, and I couldn't stick around to see what had happened. Not with everything on fire."
I put my hand over hers. "You did what you had to do. It was the right thing. She was, is, an evil person."
"I suppose," Sydney said with a sigh. "And I guess this answers our questions. We've been trying to figure out who would have a vendetta against me and could use human magic. She's the perfect fit."
"Now that we know she's behind this, let's go after her and get Jill," growled Eddie. This life on the road had made him shave even less, and he was well on his way to a beard. "She left that clue. She's in Palm Springs. She needs to be stopped once and for all."
"Agreed," Sydney said, snapping out of her earlier malaise. "We need to finish this and get Jill. None of us are going to sleep anytime soon. We might as well hit the road now and go to Palm Springs."
"Not you," said Jackie. "I don't want you anywhere near Palm Springs right now."
"What?"
exclaimed Sydney. Her intensity was a match for Eddie's.
"But that's the next piece of this. Alicia all but told us."
"And that's why we're not going to rush into this. At least not right away."
"But Jill,"
Eddie began. Jackie shook her head.
"We don't yet know the extent of Jill's involvement in this. What we do know is that Alicia is baiting Sydney and wants her to come to Palm Springs, where there's probably a very neatly laid trap. Alicia's also following her old pattern of wearing out an enemy first. This scavenger hunt wasn't just for her amusement. It was to weaken Sydney magically. If you run off to Palm Springs now, after the magic you've wielded these last few days, you might very well succumb to whatever she has in store. Then we lose you and never find out what's become of Jill."
I felt conflicted and tightened my hold on Sydney's hand. I could understand why Jackie wanted to keep Sydney away from danger. I wanted that too, but I also felt the increasing pressure that everyone else did. Each passing day put Jill at greater risk. How could we not take action when we had a lead?
"But," continued Jackie, as though reading my mind, "that's not to say I have any intention of just abandoning Jill. I want to conduct a search in Palm Springs, specifically the Salton Sea area, but I plan on doing it with appropriate backup."
Eddie and I were both confused, but Sydney, as usual, caught on fastest.
"Estelle," she said, referring to the coven of witches she'd joined.
Jackie nodded.
"Them and others. Alicia isn't just your problem. She represents a problem for the entire magical community. And so the entire community will deal with her. I'll get them together, and we'll conduct a search using magical and conventional means. You, meanwhile, will stay somewhere safe, somewhere far away."
And I'll stay with you, I said, feeling a little bit better knowing that Jill wasn't being abandoned. It was tough, almost like I had to choose between Sydney and Jill, but it sounded like Jackie wouldn't be sitting around idly.
I'll go with you, Eddie told Jackie. Then he turned to Sydney and me. That is... The conflict on his face mirrored what I felt inside. Go, I said. We'll be okay. No one knows we're gone yet. We'll disappear somewhere and be fine. Eddie hesitated again. He hated to have his loyalties torn, but at last he nodded. As long as you think you'll be okay. How did you get away without anyone knowing? I'll tell you some other time, I said. I could tell from Sydney's expression she was interested in that story, too. She looked at Jackie instead. But I want you to call me as soon as you and the other witches have things secure. As soon as you think it's safe, I want to be a part of the hunt for Jill.
Unless we find her first and defeat Alicia, insisted Eddie.
Sydney gave him a small smile that suggested she didn't think it'd be that easy. I would love that. The four of us hashed out a few more details before finally parting ways. I could tell it still bothered Eddie to be leaving us, and he was full of advice on how we should lie low and not attract any attention. He also wanted to send for Neil to guard us, but Sydney dismissed that idea, saying it'd be easier for us to just slip away now. We all agreed Neil might be handy in Palm Springs when we closed in on Alicia, so Eddie promised to make that happen. Don't worry, I assured Eddie, clapping him on the back after a few more of his well-intentioned pieces of caution. I have no intention of doing anything that's going to let alchemists or Maroi know we've left court. You go do your thing, we'll do ours, and then you can let us know when it's safe to join you. Jackie and Eddie both agreed they didn't want to know where Sydney and I were going. The less they knew, the less they could accidentally reveal to others. They were both filled with advice on the kinds of places we should go, however, and I finally had to send them both on their way and tell them we'd be fine. That left Sydney and me in our rental car, suddenly faced with infinite possibilities. It was also the first time we'd truly been alone in a very long time. It's a little overwhelming, she admitted to me as we sat in the restaurant's parking lot. It's like we could suddenly live out any of our escape plans. Well, not any, I remarked. We're in the middle of the United States and need to be safely lodged somewhere in 5 hours so that I can, meet up with Nina in a dream. Sydney's eyes widened.
What?
I sighed and started the car. Let me explain. I'd known it would all have to come out. I just hadn't expected it to come out this soon. So we got on a highway headed north, and I briefed Sydney on what had happened in the days we'd been apart. Nina had made good on her word about covering for me. She'd driven me out of court in her own car, using compulsion on the gate guard so that he wouldn't remember seeing me. After she'd dropped me off at a small regional airport, she'd promised to go to our rooms in guest housing and stay with my mom. In the 24 hours it had taken me to catch connecting flights and drive to Sydney's location in the Ozarks, I'd heard updates from both Nina and my mom. No one had come looking for me, and Nina had strolled down to the lobby and had a compulsion-filled conversation that convinced the desk attendant she'd seen me leave and come back for a feeding. And now I've got to hold up my part of the bargain, I explained to Sydney, once I'd recapped the backstory.
By engaging in a bunch of spirit use that's burning her out? Cried Sydney. Adrian, you told me you'd back off.
She doesn't understand, snarled Aunt Tatiana.
You did this for her.
I felt my anger rise in response.
It was the only way I could get away from court.
You didn't have to get away from court, Sydney argued.
We were fine. You just needed to stay safe and cover for us. Fine? I saved you from getting sliced up by those blades.
Sydney crossed her arms over her chest and stared obstinately out the passenger side window. We don't know how bad the damage would have been, and Ms. Terwilliger and I might have gotten off a spell at the last second. But this spirit walking with Nina? We do know the kind of damage it can do.
You just said she's in bad shape.
My helping her will prevent her from getting worse, I retorted. One time isn't going to hurt me. Sydney turned back to me, incredulous.
No, not one time, not any time. You can't do this. I can't let you.
Since when does she control you? Demanded Aunt Tatiana, raging.
Barely married a month and she's already dictating your life. You can't stand for that. Tell her. Tell her that she can't control you.
I was as worked up as the phantom in my head, and I opened my mouth, ready to snap something harsh back at Sydney. Then, glancing over, I caught sight of her face in the passing glow of another car's headlights. The concern and love I saw in her features pierced my heart, and like that, the anger went out of me.
She's deceiving you, insisted Aunt Tatiana.
No, I replied back. She just cares about me. She wants to help. To Sydney, I said, okay, you're right. It's not a good idea. I won't engage in the dream. I'll just find some way to explain things to Nina. I felt guilty going back on my word to Nina, but I had greater vows binding me to Sydney. When I saw the relief those words brought to her, I knew I'd made the right choice.
Nina isn't going to like this, hissed Aunt Tatiana.
I'm not married to Nina, I retorted. Sydney moved her hand over mine.
Thank you, Adrian. I know it's not easy. I know you just want to help.
I do, I admitted, still conflicted by the decision. The instinct to help Nina was so, so strong. But there's a cost to it. My sanity's not worth it. I squeezed Sydney's hand back. Our relationship's not worth it.
I told you Nina isn't going to like this, warned Aunt Tatiana again. You can pat yourself on the back for protecting your sanity, but hers is long gone. She's not just going to let you walk out of your deal.
I'll deal with Nina. For now, it's worth it just to have some alone time with Sydney and not be fighting for a change. It was true. Sydney and I hadn't had anything even remotely close to this kind of freedom in a long time, and even if we were stuck in the middle of the United States instead of some tropical island, the options before us suddenly seemed limitless. After mulling over some internet maps, we finally made our way to Council Bluffs, Iowa. It didn't exactly scream excitement, but that was kind of the point. Most importantly, it was far away from the Alchemists in St. Louis, and even farther from Palm Springs, where Alicia was hoping Sydney would show up. We debated checking into a large chain hotel, and finally settled on a small country inn just outside the town. We pulled up to it late in the morning, and were greeted by a sign proclaiming, Welcome to the Black Squirrel Lodge.
Oh no, groaned Sydney. Please don't let this be like that place in Los Angeles. I don't know if I can handle a room full of squirrel decor.
I grinned, thinking back to the time Sydney and I had investigated another bed and breakfast that had taken rabbits to an unprecedented height in tacky decorating.
Hey, come on. After everything else we've been through, that'd be the least of our worries.
But when we stepped inside, we were pleasantly surprised to see everything was actually pretty tastefully decorated in neutral colors and modern decor. No quilts with squirrels on them or squirrel-shaped wicker sculptures in sight. The innkeeper, though surprised to see guests this early in the day, was happy to welcome us and get us into a room.
What's with the inn's name? I asked as I paid for the room.
The innkeeper, a kindly middle-aged woman, beamed.
Oh, that's in honor of Cashew.
Cashew? Asked Sydney. The innkeeper nodded.
Our resident black squirrel. I'd call him our pet, but, well, he's so much more than that.
I peered farther into the lobby. Does he have a cage here or something?
Oh, no, she said. That'd be cruel. Also illegal. He's...
She shrugged and gestured vaguely with her hand.
Well, he's around somewhere.
What do you mean, around? Asked Sydney uneasily.
Like, outside?
Oh, no, said the innkeeper.
Poor thing wouldn't know what to do out there.
Sydney's eyes widened.
Wait, if he's not outside, then does that mean... Let's get you two into your room, said the innkeeper sunnily. I've got your key right here.
The room she took us to had a cozy sitting area and access to a private porch, as well as a big plush bed. After an uncomfortable day of travel, I was looking forward to catching up on sleep and finally getting some real rest. Before I could throw myself on the mattress, however, I knew I needed to get in touch with Nina and tell her the deal was off. When Sydney said she wanted to take a shower, I saw the perfect opportunity. It was just around the time Nina would be asleep, waiting for me to contact her through a spirit dream. I didn't have to be asleep for that, simply in a meditative state. I sat on the bed, calming myself and closing my eyes. calling on just enough spirit to reach across the dream world to Nina. My tranquil state was shattered, however, when I heard a scream from the bathroom. I opened my eyes and tore across the room, flinging the door open.
"Adrian, look out!" cried Sydney.
A small, furry black form leapt off the counter, landing right on my chest. Out of instinct, I swatted it off. It landed on the floor and went scurrying off across the room. Sydney, wrapped in a towel, stepped out and stood beside me.
"I think it went under the bed," she said.
"That thing better not get on me again," I muttered, walking gingerly over to the edge of the bed.
"You've faced much worse than this," Aunt Tatiana said scornfully. "Stop being foolish."
Sydney followed, and when I lifted a corner of the bed frame up, she waved her hand in what I recognized as a gesture for casting spells. Seconds later, I felt a breeze stir and blow under the bed. Moments later, the squirrel, Cashew, I presumed, came tearing out and began frantically racing around the room. Sydney, courageously overcoming her earlier shock, darted over to the door that led to the porch and opened it. After a few circuits of the room, the squirrel noticed and ran out. Sydney slammed the door shut behind him, and for several seconds we both just stood there.
"Why?" she asked at last. "Can't anything ever just be simple for us?"
"Look at you," I teased, walking over to her, "fearlessly vanquishing Cashew the deranged squirrel."
"I wasn't so fearless initially," she admitted. "Not when he jumped out at me when I was about to get in the shower."
I pulled her to me, suddenly very aware of how little she was wearing and how gorgeous she looked, even after a close call with a squirrel.
"Hey, you were braver than me. And look, you did it all without losing that towel."
Amusement lit Sydney's features as she let me draw her near. She patted the top of the towel where it wrapped around her chest.
"It's all in how you fold it," she said practically. "Do it the right way and nothing will get it off."
"Challenge accepted," I murmured, bringing my lips down to hers. She melted into me, warm and vibrant and smelling exquisitely of Sydney. I pressed her against the wall, bringing us closer together, and she wrapped a leg around my hip. I ran a hand over the smooth, perfect skin of her thigh, and it hit me that we were truly alone for the first time in a very long while. My mother wasn't outside our door. We didn't have an entire court of Moroi surrounding us, waiting for us to step outside, or a team of alchemists hunting us beyond its walls. We'd lost ourselves. We'd made an escape plan. No one knew we were here. If we'd wanted to, the power to simply disappear was right before us. I think that knowledge, that we were truly and really free for the first time, sparked an extra intensity between us. There was a heat in Sydney as she kissed me back and entwined her fingers in my hair that reminded me of our early days together. I lifted her easily in my arms and carried her over to the bed, amazed at how the strongest women I knew could feel so light in my arms. I was also amazed at how difficult that towel was to get off. Sydney laughed softly, trailing her fingers along my cheek. The sunlight peeping in around the window blinds made her look like she was made of gold.
"Uh-oh," she said. "Are you going to fail in your challenge?"
I finally untwisted the fold and removed the towel, tossing it as far from the bed as I could.
"No way," I said, as always in awe of her body.
"It takes a lot more than that to keep me away. You'll have to try harder next time." She helped pull my shirt off over my head.
"Now why would I want to do that?"
We kissed again, and as we became entangled in each other, I found all the worries that had chased me and the rest of the world disappearing. Nina, the alchemists, Alicia, even Aunt Tatiana. There was no one in the world but Sydney and me just then, and the only things that mattered were our love and the way I felt in her arms. It was a joy that went beyond just physical pleasure, though I'd be lying if I said there wasn't plenty of that. Afterward, sweaty and exhausted, we curled up with each other in a much calmer way. She rested her head on my chest, and I kissed her forehead contentedly. I decided then that the best thing that could happen would be if Jackie called and told us Alicia had been dealt with, Jill was free, and Sydney and I could live happily ever after in Council Bluffs. I drifted off to sleep, happily dreaming about that fantasy. It was short-lived, however, as I was soon pulled into a very different kind of dream. Aunt Tatiana's warning came back to me, about how Nina wasn't going to just let me walk out on our deal.
"Where have you been?"
exclaimed Nina. The farmhouse in Wisconsin materialized before us.
"You were supposed to find me."
I stared around, trying to gather my bearings at this unexpected change in venue. Sorry, I got distracted in the real world and fell asleep.
"Well, no problem," she said briskly. "I'll just lead the dream. Remember, you've got to wield more spirit this time."
My eyes widened.
"No, Nina, wait!"
But Nina wasn't listening. She was too caught up in her obsessive mission of finding Olive. I felt Nina call on spirit and bring another person to join us. Moments later, Olive began materializing in the room before us, as shadowy and cloaked as before. And just like before, panic seized Olive, and she began to wrest the dream away from Nina. This time, knowing what to expect, I was more aware of it happening. Since that last attempt, I'd looked into dreamwalking as much as I could, though there really wasn't much to go off of. I'd even chatted with Sonia, and we'd decided it came down to Olive's will. If her motivation was great enough, she could overcome the spirit user who was controlling the dream she was in. And clearly, that was happening now.
"You're a stronger dreamwalker than Nina," Aunt Tatiana reminded me. "The strongest of any dreamwalker."
"I know," I told her. And as I saw the setting dissolving, I made an impulse decision, going against what I told Sydney I'd do. "Let go of the dream," I said to Nina. Understanding my intent, she complied. I was ready, channeling spirit, and I swooped in to become the dream's new master. The farmhouse, which had been crumbling, began to rematerialize. Likewise, Olive also began solidifying.
"No!"
she cried. Nina hurried toward her.
"Olive, I've missed you so much!"
Olive's face was filled with fear, and she backed up quickly, wrapping the cloak more tightly around her.
"No! No! Please leave me alone!"
And like that, I started to feel the dream slipping away from me. Despite my hold, Olive's will was still winning out. Cracks appeared in the wooden walls. The wicker furniture crumbled to dust. The windows filled with sunlight went dark. I called on Spirit's power, pulling more magic through me in order to fight back against Olive's usurpation. Spirit burned within my body, but she'd already changed the face of the dream. The house was gone, replaced by what looked like a hotel parking lot. A flickering street lamp cast weak light down on us, eerily supplemented by the red glow of a neon sign hanging in the lobby's window. What normally might have been busy streets surrounded us, but no traffic flowed on them in this dream. Eerie silence dominated until I spoke.
"I'm sorry. She was too fast," I said to Nina.
"Where are we?" She took a step closer to me, her face filled with fear.
"This is where we were attacked with our dad. When Olive was turned, there were Strigoi."
Before she could finish, two menacing figures emerged from behind the dark shape of a parked Buick. The phantom lighting made their pale white skin look even more gruesome. I couldn't see the red in their eyes, but the evil within came through plainly, no matter the dim conditions. They snarled, revealing fangs similar to mine, save that their only intent was to kill. I gripped Nina's hand and slowly backed up.
"They can't kill us in a dream," I said, my mouth suddenly dry. "Not really."
"No, but we'll wake up," she said, "and Olive will be gone again." "Not if we annihilate them first." Terror filled me, even though I knew the Strigoi were only part of the dream. I'd been too conditioned against them my entire life to feel anything except fear. But what I'd said was true. You couldn't die in a spirit dream. You would simply wake up, and before that, you'd feel deep, excruciating pain. "They aren't real," I told myself. "This is a dream, and I still have some control." Olive had taken charge of big things, like the setting, but little things were within my grasp. Here, I could wield fire as deftly as Christian or Sydney. A fireball appeared in my hand, fueled by spirit magic. I felt magic surge in Nina, too, and I was quick to chastise her.
"No! Let me handle this!"
If I was caught in this dream, I might as well fulfill the original goal of keeping her away from the brunt of spirit.
"Just assist. Don't wield too much."
I hurled the fireball toward one of the Strigoi, and it went wide, missing him by about 2 feet. Okay, maybe I couldn't wield fire quite as deftly as Christian or Sydney. It had always looked so easy when Sydney did it, and I realized I was thinking in those terms, imitating her throw. But relying on my physical abilities wasn't the way to go. I had to be much more intentional. I summoned another fireball and this time used spirit to specifically guide it toward the Strigoi. My aim proved true, but the Strigoi, even in a dream, moved quickly. He dodged the brunt of the fireball and only ended up singeing his arm. It was enough to inspire me, though. I called on spirit again, summoning 2 more fireballs, one to keep going after this target and another to keep the other Strigoi at a distance. I also managed to anticipate the way the Strigoi would dodge this time, so I adjusted accordingly, sending the fireball right into his chest. Flames engulfed him, and I used spirit to summon a silver stake. Moving to where he writhed on the ground, I called on spirit to shield me from the fire as I plunged the stake into what I hoped was his heart. Either I was right, or the fire had already done its job, because the creature suddenly stopped moving and vanished into nothing. The other Strigoi had tried to advance on Nina while I was